Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Fire Interview, the Storyteller Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Brendan Trainer. Today, we have Fire Chief Dennis Compton. Dennis Compton got the Arizona Fire Chief's Lifetime Achievement Award, the Metropolitan Chief's Lifetime Achievement Award. He's inducted into the National Heritage Hall of Legends. He's in the Firehouse Hall of Fame. He was an executive board member for the International Fire Service Training Association. He's been the chairman of the Congressional Fire Service Institute, chairman of the National Firefighters Foundation, amongst about a million other chairs that he sat in and executive board memberships. He was an assistant chief for the Phoenix Fire Department and the fire chief of the Mesa Fire Department. He was in command of the FEMA team, the USAR team. He was the first one on scene of the Oklahoma City bombing out of all the USAR teams. He's worked in Washington. He's worked at the Pentagon. He was there when the plane hit the Pentagon. He was sent to Ground Zero to set up their command and their communications. He tells a ton of great stories. We ask him a ton of chief questions. We ask about accountability, terminating employees, all kinds of great conversation and great information from Chief Compton. It's going to be a good one. Thanks for joining us. Fire Interview, the Storyteller Podcast, is brought to you by the book Fire Interview, the Storyteller Method. This is a book that gives you a five-step process to master the craft of scoring full points on your fire department interview. You can get the book at fire-interview.com along with all of our podcast merchandise. We're also brought to you by PSA, publicsafetyanswers.com. Publicsafetyanswers.com provides recruit testing for departments nationwide. They do behavioral and cognitive online tests. They can take care of your application period. They can give video interviews direct to the departments. There's no cap on the number of applicants you have, and there's no fees for the fire department. So make sure you go to publicsafetyanswers.com if you're looking to bring your fire recruitment to the 21st century. Chief, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, Brendan.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you here. You're the first guest that we've had that is the fire chief of a fire department, so we couldn't be more excited to have you.
Well, like I said, it's really nice to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
So when did you start in the fire service? What year was it?
I started on the Phoenix Fire Department January 17th of 2000, January 17th of 1971.
1971.
Yes.
And, okay. And why did you want to be a firefighter? Did you have family in the fire service, or what led you to Phoenix Fire?
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to be a firefighter.
No.
It's an interesting story. Back then, things were much different than they are today regarding firefighters and testing and all that stuff. But I was in the Army in 1968 and 69. And when I got out of the Army, my wife and I went to a party on a Saturday night. And a friend of mine there had just gotten on the Phoenix Fire Department about 6 months before. And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him, you know, really not much right now. He said, well, you know what? The fire department's getting ready to test. He said, you need to go down there and take that test. He said, you would really like that job. So I went down and took the test.
The rest is history.
And that was it. You know, it was a different situation. You took the written. There were about 300 people there or so. You took the written. When you got done, you walked up front, and the proctor graded it with you standing right there. And if you passed, they gave you a ticket to go down and take an agility test. And so I went down and took that right away. Just a couple hours later, I was taking that test. Took an interview a few weeks later, and next thing you know, I'm on the job.
How many people were on Phoenix Fire in 71? Do you remember?
There were about 500 people on the job. A little less.
Okay.
So right around that.
It's grown a little bit?
Just a tad.
Yeah, it's interesting that 300 people were testing in 71. I know Phoenix has had some tests with close to 5,000 people testing. It's always been a very popular job. Why do you think that is? Why do you think, it boggles people's mind when we tell them how competitive it is. Hey, we're going to hire 10 people, and there's thousands of applicants. You have any thoughts on why you think that's it's such a popular job?
Well, think about how much more the public knows about firefighters today than they ever did when I was young. Look at all the movies and the TV series and stuff that's come about. Look at how visible and visual firefighters are and fires are and other emergencies are. And look how many people who are on fire departments have children who want to follow in their footsteps and friends who want to follow. And we recruit, whether we're formal recruiters or not, we're seems like we're always recruiting good people to go down and take that test.
Yeah.
And so I think it's an evolutionary process that took place. For, and another thing, you know, I took a pay cut to go on the fire department. And I didn't have a real good job.
Yeah.
But I took a pay cut to go on the fire department, and I'm not unusual.
You hear that from a lot of people, took a pay cut.
Yeah, and so I actually had to work a side job to make our house payment. I didn't make enough money. And my wife was pregnant and gave birth just 2.5 months after I was hired. So I had to work a side job in order to make enough money to pay our expenses and make a house payment.
Yeah. So then you get hired as a firefighter. At that time in Phoenix, there were no paramedics, right?
There were no paramedics.
EMTs or paramedics.
Mm-mm.
Until 79. Is that about when EMS got started in Phoenix?
Oh, no, it was much before that.
Oh, it was before that.
We went on first aid calls. In fact, in recruit training, which was 3 weeks long, in recruit training, we had 8 hours of Red Cross first aid training.
Okay.
There was a green Red Cross first aid book, and that was our textbook. It was 8 hours of training. So when we were dispatched on a call that was a first aid call, that's what it was called. So you got dispatched to a first aid call.
Okay.
And there weren't that many of them. But we would go and we'd do our best. We didn't have much equipment. We didn't have much training. But it was about 1973.
Okay.
Almost 74, in fact, when we had our first medics. And it was a result of Rescue 51, the TV show.
Johnny and Roy.
we got that through the council, primarily because of the popularity of that show. And people began wondering, why don't we have that kind of service? Why don't we get that? Do we get that? No. But why don't we get that?
Yeah.
And so the next thing you know, and Jim Page, who was the technical associate director for Rescue 51, was also a good friend of ours, Phoenix Fire. And he helped as well. And Dr. Jim Shamadan, whose son is a deputy chief on the Phoenix Fire Department now, was instrumental in that. And so was a councilman, city councilman, that had used to be the director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. So we had a lot of help getting that done.
How did the firefighters take it when you said, hey, we're going to all become EMTs and paramedics and we're going to start doing a bunch of medical calls? Was it well received? Was it mixed?
It was both. I was a union officer at the time. I was young. But if you were young, you looked forward to everybody having to be an EMT and you know, the opportunity to become a medic for some people, and just the way people perceive that service, you know, you look forward to it. But the people who had been on a long time, many of them didn't want anything to do with it.
Right.
And you can assume that that was totally resistance to change. But we would assume wrong. Because what we found out was that labor and management together had to sell this to the troops so that we could move forward with it and it not be a huge political issue. And what they were concerned about more than anything else was their job, depending on whether or not they passed a test that was administered from outside the fire department.
Yeah. Firefighters don't like that.
not when you got a job that you like,
yeah,
and it's secure and you've been doing it for a long time. So what we had to do, both the union officers and the chiefs and others, had to convince our department that this is not a ploy to get rid of firefighters, that we're going to all go along with this. We're going to bring everybody along. No one is going to lose their job over this. So we trained together, we studied together, we tested together, and we finally went forward together. And it was a significant change in the way the fire department did business and the way the public perceived the fire department. Huge change. It was unbelievable.
What was the change in the public perception?
That firefighters were, I'll use a term that's more common today than back then, but it really matches, that firefighters truly were becoming all risk responders, emergency responders.
Yeah.
That if you had a problem, call the fire department. And they would provide you with the service that you need to solve your problem. And before that, if you had a fire, call the fire department.
Right. It's kind of interesting that we're still called the fire department, even though at least here in Arizona, like 80% of our job is not fighting fire. At least 80%, I would say. And I talk to that when I'm doing interview prep with people. The saying is, you know, you're not a firefighter on a fire truck. You're a problem solver in a toolbox. And I think that's what you're alluding to, is that the perception change, that you don't just call firefighters when there's a fire. You can call a firefighter for any problem, and a bunch of problem solvers in a big toolbox will show up and solve your problem.
And think back. In 1973 and 74, it wasn't that we didn't have members of the public having medical emergencies. It wasn't that they weren't having car crashes. It wasn't that they weren't being knifed and shot. Because they were. But the people who ran the medical end of that were mostly ambulances, and they were very poorly trained, very poorly paid, and the public saw this change, this difference on TV, and thought, wait a minute, you know, why can't we get that? In other words, it's for us, it's like being thrown in a truck and taken to the hospital, and for these other people on TV, they get all this gee whiz medical care.
Yeah. So that's an interesting transition into Phoenix Fire is one of the fire departments that runs their own ambulances, and they have firefighters on the ambulance. So there's a bunch of different ways you could do this, right? You can have a private ambulance contract. You can have a fire department run ambulance service with firefighters on it, or with civilian EMTs and paramedics. What do you think the pros and cons are to having, are you in favor of firefighters on ambulances? Do you think it's better to have civilians? Do you think private contracts are better?
Well, I am a strong supporter of fire-based EMS. I mean, I chaired a coalition in Washington, D.C., started it in 2006 and chaired it till 2018. A coalition of the major fire organizations, and it was based on advocating for fire-based EMS systems. So I am a strong supporter of that. But we didn't have ambulances in Phoenix Fire until about 1985. Before that, we had private providers. In fact, at one time, we had seven of them. Seven different companies.
Yeah.
So we had a list. So when someone had
who's up?
When someone called, when a fire crew was on the scene of an EMS call and needed an ambulance, they called the alarm room. The alarm room called the next up company. If they couldn't handle it, they called the next up company, the next up company. And that just could not go on. Because I also don't believe in profit-based public safety.
Yeah.
You might get a feeling that I come from that standpoint. I don't believe in it. And I'll tell you why. I've lived it. I lived through that time, and so did a lot of other people. And believe me, there was a huge difference in the service you got if you lived on East Lincoln in central Phoenix, or East Lincoln in North Phoenix.
Yeah.
And it had a lot to do with whether or not you were probably insured and whether or not that was going to be a paid response.
Yeah.
And that's ridiculous. And so it was because we couldn't deal with those companies. We even had laws that were preventing us, you know, the antitrust laws and stuff. So we decided we were going to bid against those companies for the service in Phoenix. Just straight up bid against them.
Yeah, it seems like in emergency services, whether it's fire, EMS, police, whatever it is, to be a for-profit company in an emergency service is a little bit of a conflict of interest, you know, because you're trying to get profit. That's the goal of your company. You're not a nonprofit. You're a for-profit company. And I remember experiencing that before I was a firefighter. I was on an ambulance, and I won't throw the company under the bus, but I don't think they're in existence anymore anyway. But I was on a 911 ambulance, and we didn't even have an AED. And this is 2005 or 2006. And there's AEDs at the airport. There's AEDs in gyms, LA Fitness. Even police officers had AEDs in their cars. And we're a 911 ambulance. We don't have an AED. And so we're a brand new ambulance company. And I call my supervisor. I'm like, hey, I think we're missing a pretty important piece of equipment. Can we come down and pick one up, kind of thing? And he goes, it's not in the contract, so we're not buying them, because the department didn't, whatever, and I won't throw the department under the bus either, but that department didn't put in the contract that we had to carry that because they had one on the fire truck. Well, the area that we worked in was a pretty rural area. There's a good chance that we're going to be on scene for a long time by ourselves. You know, and again, to the general public, like 10 minutes might not seem like a long time, but it is when somebody's not breathing. It feels like forever. And I remember thinking that, like, man, it said on the fire department, if we're missing a piece of critical equipment, we go get it, right? Or we buy it, or we ask the town or the citizens, we say, hey, we really need this, and we have that support. And they say, great, let's buy AEDs, or now we have advanced cardiac monitors. But yeah, in the for-profit world, it's like, yeah, it's not on the contract, we're not buying it.
You know, it isn't the employees of those companies.
No.
It isn't. I never knew of them to not do the best they could do. The best they could do with the training and the best they could with what they had.
Absolutely.
It wasn't them.
Nope.
It was the corporate mentality of the company versus the corporate mentality of a public safety entity. And it boils down to this. Okay, I mean, you want to define it straight up, is when you have a private for-profit company delivering public safety services, when those crews have done the best they can do and they return back to the station, the people who run that company want to know if the patient paid. But when you have a fire department go on a call and they do the best they can with what they have and they come back to their headquarters, the chiefs want to know if the patient lived.
Yeah.
And that's the difference.
Yeah. What could we have done better instead of what, you know?
That is the difference.
Yeah.
You know, it's straight difference. Up. In one, it's cultural. And it's a corporate culture. It's not the firefighters. It's not the ambulance attendants. It's a corporate culture that gets instilled in that organization. And yeah. That's the beef I've always had with it.
Yeah. It's something that seems to be changing here, at least here in the Valley. It's turning over pretty fast. So
what's been changing for a long time, Brenda?
Yeah.
A long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been like turtle speed.
Yeah.
That it's been changing. But think how goofy the system is in ways. I mean, literally, for an unincorporated area, you can be a tax-paying citizen in one part of a community here in the Valley, and I'm not going to mention any right. of them, but there are several.
Yeah.
And you can literally drive two stoplights outside that community, get in a wreck, be upside down in your vehicle with your kids, and the community you paid your taxes to won't respond to that incident.
Yeah.
Because you're a mile outside of the jurisdiction. If you had gone 3 more miles, you were back in the jurisdiction.
Right.
That's how cut up the system is.
Yeah.
And so it's just crazy.
One of the things that we're kind of famous for here in the Valley is the automatic aid system. Do you want to explain to people who maybe aren't from Arizona what automatic aid is and how Phoenix Fire implemented that and what's awesome about automatic aid?
I would love to. That's about a 1976, 1977 concept that started. Nothing like what it is today, but started then. And it wasn't just Phoenix. It was Glendale, Tempe, and Phoenix. And they began a response agreement with no document, no contract, no nothing. Just that we would send the closest unit and that we would begin at some point to start training our troops on the same stuff.
Yeah.
So the same skills, the same procedures, everything. Okay. And what automatic aid is a boundary drop. Not for administration and not for logistics, not for any of those things, support services, fire prevention. It doesn't drop the boundaries there. It drops the boundaries for emergency response. So having access to all those resources in one or two or three communication centers, you can dispatch the closest unit to a call all the time. Okay.
No matter what city they're from, it doesn't matter.
And when we implemented GPS, that made that even more effective because you weren't dealing only with fixed locations. And the winner in that is the customer. Is the winner in automatic aid isn't the fire department. The winner in that is the customer that called 911 and how quickly they get their service and how effective that service is.
Yeah, you know, you fast forward to 2021 now, I think there's more than 30 cities in automatic aid, and we operate without borders. It doesn't matter if you're in Gilbert or Mesa or Queen Creek or you're in Goodyear or Peoria, wherever, whatever the closest. We have that up and all the time. Somebody calls 911 and we respond to Chandler or Mesa, and they go, "Why? Your shirt says Gilbert Fire." And it's like, yeah, we were the closest truck, and we all train the same way in Volume 2 and Phoenix Fire.
And if only some did it, then you might have an issue with it as the public. But automatic aid is reciprocal aid. And that's very important because you have to be staffed a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be trained a certain way. You have to be equipped a certain way. And so it's not identical, but it's about as close as you're ever going to get is reciprocal aid. But I'll tell you, don't think that system just got planted on the ground.
Oh, I'm sure.
All of a sudden, it was perfect.
I'm sure it didn't.
Because it was rough.
And
each time we brought in more people, it got rougher. You know, because a lot of it was just goofy stuff.
A lot of politics involved in that.
You know, the politics were mostly internal.
Yeah.
They were who was the best firefighters and who had this and who had that and who's going to command a deal in whose city and. Yeah, but once you got through all that, and after about 20 years we did, got through a lot of it. But I understand that some of that crap still happens today.
Yeah.
That's still automatic aid system, the boundary drop system that we have here in Arizona, in central Arizona, I think is the most effective service delivery system that exists in the United States, even among those who've tried to copy it.
Yeah, it's pretty effective here.
Oh my God.
All being under pretty much two alarm rooms cover the whole valley, which
two
is
alarm
also
rooms.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So after you get hired, how long till you start promoting up through the ranks, engineer, captain, so on and so forth?
Me or people?
You.
Oh, me. You know, that depends on where you're at, you know? Phoenix was in a growth period,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I came on the job, but probably about 5, 6, 7 years later, began to grow. The valley began to grow. Mm-hmm. And the fire department wasn't staffed or deployed very effectively for that. And that hardly ever is. One thing you'll always see with growth, whether you're in Gilbert or Phoenix or anywhere else, is the growth occurs before the infrastructure occurs.
Yeah,
so the growth occurs before the fire station gets there. But But it it depends on where you're at. If you, I promoted to engineer in a little under 4 years, and there were a lot of, you know, I finished real high on the list, so I got promoted real quickly. I promoted to captain. I had about 8 years on the job, I think, and I was actually number one on that list, and then battalion chief a few years later, again with growth. There was a new battalion being implemented, so I took advantage of the opportunities as they came, as did a lot of other people. That's one of the reasons I'm not so concerned about what people are talking about, with so many people leaving and you're losing all the experience and this and that and the other.
Right.
You know, we've been through this. And when a lot of people leave, it means that a lot of young ones come into those positions. And they have the experience that they bring. And it does require additional training. And it is important to provide that. But there's a experience isn't time on the job. Experience is exposure. I've worked with people that had been on the job 15 years, and the only experience they had was showing up for 15 years.
Yeah.
I worked with other people that had 3 years on the job, who were more experienced than some who had 20.
Yeah. Did you have any, because I'm a young captain as well, did you experience any pushback from the people that you were overseeing because you only had 8 years on? How did you deal with that?
Well, I worked all my time at very busy fire stations, so I was fortunate in that sense, okay? And again, the call structure was different back then. I mean, we had a lot of fires back then, especially in that central Phoenix area, but throughout Phoenix, we had a lot of fires, structure fires, for a lot of reasons, but we had a lot of them.
Yeah.
But yes, and I think anybody that says they didn't's not being truthful with you. I remember telling a couple guys up at Station 1 one time on the second floor, to shut the F up. I'm getting old as fast as I can. and just left it at that and walked away. You know? The more you act as if you don't know what you're doing, the more people think you don't know what you're doing. I cringe when I see people say, hey, I'm going to have to depend on you guys a lot because I don't know X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
You know, that's like writing yourself an asterisk next to your name.
Yeah.
This is Captain So-and-so, but he doesn't know what he's supposed to be doing, and he said so.
Yeah.
You know? So I think confidence without arrogance, I think training, education, caring about people.
Yeah, that confidence without arrogance, it's a tough battle, because if you come in too confident, then people don't like that you're too confident, and if you come in too humble, like you said, saying, hey, I'm new, I'm going to be leaning on you guys, then that comes across as not being experienced and not being able to take care of people. So it's an interesting balance for the young lieutenants and captains across the country. How to balance that, being confident in what you're doing, but also being humble and not steamrolling. Because you see that from new captains too, where they just steamroll the crew and, hey, I'm in charge and I got the bugles and do what I tell you to do. And that doesn't go over real well either.
But be a coach, you know. The best supervisors I've ever seen in the fire service are good coaches. You know, we're a team. I'm going to use the best that I can out of each and every person on this team to get this job done. You know? And that's not saying, hey, I don't know anything. It's saying that we are a team, and we're going to work these together, and we're going to do our jobs together. We're going to win together. We're going to fail together.
Yeah,
that's
like
who
that.
We are. We. We. It's not... And it's not hard to learn that because you were taught it in the training academy.
Right.
Is what we do well, we do as a team. And if you think about it, if you think about an officer that is caring, empathetic, compassionate, knowledgeable, skilled, and humble, you got a hell of a confident leader there. Okay? You take that one thing called humility out of that and replace it with egotistical, and what you have is an arrogant officer. And it's just that one change.
Humility, that's the key.
Humility, well, they're all key. But without humility, arrogance creeps into that equation real quickly.
Yeah, I think that's something that me and a lot of people struggle with in the fire service, because a lot of A-type personalities, because, you know, some people would say you kind of have to be an A-type personality to run into burning buildings and go on emergency calls. But I think that's something that I know I struggle with, and I'm sure a lot of people do, is that humility part. Trying to be a confident, capable leader and a good coach, but also be humble at the same time. So I think you said it perfectly. So you become a captain, you work your way up to chief, eventually you become assistant chief with Phoenix Fire, and then you move on to become the fire chief of Mesa Fire. So tell me about that transition. You're with Phoenix Fire. Was that a difficult decision to jump ship to another department? What was the goal, or what was going on at that time?
Well, I was in Phoenix Fire for pushing 28 years, you know, a little less. It's a long time. And I had been the assistant chief there for 15 years for Chief Brunicini.
Yeah, it's a long time.
And
that's a good chief to work
with. And I loved my job. Yes, he was great. I loved my job. I loved my boss. I loved everything about Phoenix Fire. But the fact of the matter is this. I had gone to school to get an education to be a fire chief. I had prepared myself to be a fire chief. And I realized that the fire chief, that Phoenix only has one fire chief, and they got a very good one.
Yeah.
So if I want to be a fire chief, I'm going to have to go somewhere else. Now, I could have gone several places, invited me to come to their fire departments. I'm very fortunate for that. Mesa was one of them, right here in the valley. I didn't even have to leave the valley. It was a gut-wrenching decision whether or not to do it. But I think it was just the realization that if I wanted to be a fire chief in a large fire department, and Mesa's a metro fire department, that I was going to have to go somewhere else to do it, probably. And it turned out, by the way, that I was right.
Yeah.
Chief Brunicini didn't leave. I left in 1997. He left in about 2005,
yeah,
as I recall, you know.
What was the transition like going from Phoenix to Mesa? Were you pretty well received there? Did you make any big changes when you got there?
I was so blessed going over to Mesa. I knew some of those people, but not a lot of them. The union wanted me there. City management wanted me there. The political leaders wanted me there. When we talked, many of the employees wanted me there. And when we talked about where this department needed to go, it was amazing to me how similar what everybody thought it was. And so I put together a plan to talk to literally everybody who had a stake in that, including every firefighter, captain, engineer, chief on the job. every one of them. And at the time, there were about 350 of them. By the time I left, there were over 500 of them. I talked to all the city council, the mayor, the manager's office, and from that put together a plan for moving forward. This is what we're going to do. And people saw themselves in that plan. Because, Brendan, where did the plan come from?
Came from them. Yeah.
And it became quite obvious, even when I presented it to the council and to the manager's office and other, they saw themselves in that plan.
Yeah.
And so we just set out to carry it out. And I think that you ought to ask the people in Mesa who are still there whether or not I brought any change to that fire department.
You know who Jocko Willink is?
Uh-huh.
He talks about that in his book, Ownership. And I think that's important for a fire chief, speaking to someone who has no experience. But I like the way that you said, you know, it wasn't my plan. It was their plan.
It's our plan.
Yeah, you get buy-in. You get ownership from everybody, from the least senior firefighter all the way up the command staff. And that way, you know, you're operating as our plan, not my plan. And I think that probably is a big part of your success in the fire service and the reason why you have so many awards and you sit on the chair of everything. And
well, I took that same approach when I was in Phoenix. I took that same approach when I was in the Army, believe it or not. I took that same approach with all the organizations that I chaired and led. If in my initial search in Mesa, because that's not competitive, you're looking for a match. Do they match me and do I match them? So in my initial search with Mesa, had it dawned on me that there is no consistency in what these people want to do, they disagree with one another on the direction that department ought to take. I could have solved that very easily because I wouldn't have taken the job.
Right.
Is I'm not going to go over there and referee that.
Yeah.
So
before we move on to some of your big stories from your career and some of the amazing things that you've done, I'm probably not going to have an opportunity to get a lot of fire chiefs on this podcast. We'll see how it goes. So I want to throw some tough questions at you that I'm sure people will appreciate. It's not too often that you get a fire chief on the podcast of a major city, by the way. And so one thing that I'm always thinking about when you and I have talked about this before is you hear a lot of, well, it's the fire chief's discretion. It's up to the fire chief. Whether it's a decision about whether guys and gals can play basketball or it's a decision about whether somebody's going to get fired or you name it, a lot of those decisions, a lot of them are done by committee here in Arizona. You know, well, we'll put a committee together and then, but ultimately it's up to the fire chief. So can you walk me through how you make those decisions? And maybe you can give us an example of a decision that you made that wasn't very popular amongst the labor group, amongst the firefighters, and how you came to that conclusion to make that decision, knowing that it wasn't going to be popular.
Well, first of all, everything is not up to the fire chief. No matter what the people out in the world think, the fire chief has a boss, and that person has bosses, and there's a system that you're operating within too. So there's a personnel system, there's a financial system, there's all these systems that you're a part of, and the decisions you make have to somehow fit into all of that. So you don't have the latitude to go off into left field, okay? So anybody that thinks that, is their thinking is flawed, okay? You do not have that kind of total authority. But you do have a lot of authority. You do have a lot of power. There are tons of decisions that are difficult decisions, you know? I think one of the things that a fire chief can do to help them with that aspect is don't put yourself in a position where you're making all the decisions. because every time you make a decision that's a kind of an either or decision, what happens in the organization is the people in the organization split up into shirts and skins. And some people like it, and some people don't like it. Okay, I think too that having a good understanding of what fair means is important to you as well. I think we need to be as fair as we can be. I think I need to have fair almost tattooed backwards on my forehead. So every time I look in the mirror, I see the word fair. That's how important it is. But how hard is fair? You think about that. How hard is it to be fair? Because who gets to decide fair? Is it you, the person making the decision? Or is it the people on the receiving end of that decision who get to decide whether or not it was fair?
Okay. It's a good question.
It's the receiver. The receiver gets to decide fair, not the sender. The receiver. Now, we get to research whatever we want to research. We get to talk to whoever we want to talk to. We get to read whatever we want to read. But in the end, a decision's going to be made. And I have made decisions that I thought people were going to come in and put me on their shoulder and carry me out and have a party. And instead, some of them stoned me. And the reason they stoned me is that some of them thought the decision wasn't fair. So when you look at the issue of fairness, and that boils right into your question, fairness is in the eye of the beholder. And it's usually based on the answer to one question. How does that decision affect me personally?
Yeah.
If I like the way it affects me, it's fair. If I don't like the way it affects me, it's not fair. So before we talk about decision making, I think we need to understand that. You take a tough issue, and there's no way for you to come out smelling like a rose on that. And if that's the one thing that's your goal, then I feel sorry for you, because it's probably not going to happen. I remember when I went over to Mesa, one of the first things they wanted to do, because the previous people who were running that department wouldn't let them do it, they wanted to get a brush hat. This sounds stupid, but they wanted to get a brush hat. So I asked them to put together a uniform committee, and you guys come back and you...
What's a brush hat?
Hat is a hat you wear when you're out fighting brush fires.
Okay.
It's a wide rim hat. Okay.
Like a boonie cap?
Yeah.
Okay.
They wanted one of those as a uniform cap with Mesa Fire on it. I didn't have any problem with that. The committee gets together and they can't decide on one hat. So they want three hats. They select three different hats. But they can't. They can only have one hat. So who do you think they came to wanting me to pick the hat? I'm going to pick the hat for a group of people. Some are going to like it, some are not. And what difference does it make?
Yeah.
So I would have put myself in a position to be on the receiving end of all that crap. So what I told them is that, look, I know how difficult this is. Go back and decide on your hat. If you can decide on your hat, come to me. We'll do it. If you can't, we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's an example of what I'm talking about. That's not a major decision.
Right.
But don't put yourself in a position where you're making all the 50-50 decisions on that job. And in that case, it was 33, 33, 33.
Yeah.
It's just don't do it. You know?
Yeah, you don't have to always make the final decision. And put it right back on
that. Not on something like that, you sure as hell don't. Why even have work groups?
Yeah.
If you can't get decisions out of them.
Which is also good, I think, for succession planning. You know, I've had some good mentors who you come to them, and sometimes it's just for advice, but sometimes you come to them and you're wanting them to make a decision. And I think it's good succession planning when they put it right back on me. And they go, listen, man, you and your committee need to make the decision, and then you tell me what the decision is, and I'll thumbs up it or thumbs down it. But I think sometimes what some of those good leaders are doing is they're preparing you at some point to be in their position. And the only way you can do that is by sometimes making those decisions. Like, if I make all these decisions for you, you won't learn anything, you know? And so sometimes I like that when a leader comes back at me, and it doesn't mean that they won't give me guidance, but they want, like you with the hat situation, to say, listen, this is your committee. You tell me what hat you want. Don't put it on me. And I think, you know, it's not just passing the buck. I think sometimes it can be seen as that, but it's actually succession planning to say that committee leader, I'm preparing them to make bigger decisions by making them make this small decision and justify it.
Another example, it was with an apparatus committee. We were building a new, we were designing a new ladder truck. And some of the people on the committee wanted a tiller truck, the others wanted a platform truck. Okay. One of the people who was most vocal about wanting the platform truck was on the committee, and he got really angry with the committee because the final vote of the committee was a tiller truck, and it was mostly because of where it was going. Mm-hmm. It was going to a part of the city that they felt needed to have that maneuverability. Because back a while back, those trucks weren't interchangeable like that.
Right.
I mean, they didn't have the maneuverability that they do today. But anyway, they're meeting in a conference room. I'm in my office, and I hear this commotion, and I go out the door, and this guy I know, this captain, storms out of that meeting and heads out to the parking lot. And I knew him, so I followed him. And I said, hey, what's going on? He says, they just voted to get a tiller ladder truck, and I wanted a platform truck, and they won't let me participate. And I said, buddy, you don't want to participate. You want to be the fire chief. You want to decide, no matter what those other people want to do. You want that authority. And you don't have it. That's not participation. Is you want to exercise authority over those people. And you can't do it, and you're pissed off.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are things that truly happen. But I think hard decisions are bigger than that. I think decisions like what you can and can't do for PT is a huge decision to the people. And it boils down to this, you know, you're going to have a PT injury once in a while. If it gets to be more than once in a while, it's a problem. And it's not just a problem to the fire chief. It ought to be a problem to the battalion chief. It ought to be a problem to the captain. And it ought to be a problem to the employees. Because it's also a problem to the city. Mm-hmm. The city risk management people, the state comp people, those are people who have a say in all that. So if you want latitude in that, manage it. If you want to play basketball, don't play marauder ball.
Right.
You know, basketball, I've played a lot of basketball.
I think every fire department's gotten rid of basketball.
Basketball is a tough deal. And so is any other form of PT that tends to injure people significantly. I mean, knees and ankles and elbows and shoulders. And that's not... That those aren't going to fly. They aren't going to be covered injuries. Do you know what I mean? In other words, it's not just up to the fire chief what gets covered and what doesn't get covered.
Yeah.
In the end. So those are tough decisions. But I tend to think that if you can manage that yourself, fine. But if you can't, then I'll manage it.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget at the street level that, like you said, it's not up to the fire chief. There's actually a lot more layers to this. And I think we forget that sometimes because we live in the bubble that is our, you know, my station, station five, my little station. And we live in a little box and we think everything is up to the fire chief. And like you said, it's not. There's all these other things that go and play into these decisions. But another thing that I wanted to talk to you about as a fire chief is accountability. And I wanted to talk to you, and pertains to, again, to tough decisions, like when somebody gets fired, you know, somebody gets separation of employment, let go, whatever you want to call it, and what that's like as a fire chief and balancing, as a, not just a fire chief, but as a leader for anybody that's listening and a leader in your organization. How do you balance, trying to get somebody back on the right track through training and mentorship, but also holding them accountable? And then when do you pull the trigger and say, okay, that's it, you don't work here anymore? What's that look like for you as the leader of the organization, that accountability piece?
Well, that usually comes about in a couple of different ways also. You know, it's not as straightforward as what you just asked. There are things that a person can do on or off duty that are so significant that there's no way they can continue in their job. There's no way that they can continue to deliver service out of the fire department because of what happened. Okay? They have lost the trust of the organization, and they've lost the trust of the public. You know, and I could give you some example of those, but there's no need to do that. It's nasty,
right?
Ugly stuff, okay? But that's not what happens most of the time. What happens most of the time is that incremental things happen and no one deals with it. And something else happens and no one deals with it. Something else happens and it gets dealt with, but as lightly as possible. Something else happens, but it happened somewhere else and these others didn't know about it. And the next thing you know, you've got a person who is a pain in the ass to the organization. Let me just come right out and say it. They can't be supervised. The people in the field have difficulty with them. You know, the city of Phoenix, or the city of Mesa, or the city of Gilbert have policies regarding how to deal with those kinds of people. And you've bent them about as far as you can bend them.
Yeah.
You know? So the way I've always looked at that, first of all, I hate letting people go. I truly believe that the best system is a system that, first of all, doesn't hire them in the first place if they have that tendency. It's always amazed me why we would put so little time into selecting somebody and so much time into getting rid of them. That's always kind of amazed me.
Yeah.
Is that we ought to put the time into selecting them. But anyway, the selecting of them, and then the preventing things from occurring. And then when they do occur, as hard as it is, and it is, to sit across from somebody and tell them, here's what happened. Here's what's going to happen. And here's what's going to happen if I ever see it again. And mean it. That is not easy. But that sometimes is exactly what you need. You can be a very good coach, but there are times when people don't want to be coached. Mm-hmm. They're not responding to coaching. And sometimes you just got to lay it right out. And most of the time that I've had to get rid of somebody, they pretty much got rid of themselves.
Yeah.
They had pulled it as tight as you could pull that rubber band, and they got rid of themselves.
Do you think there's a lack of accountability in the fire service? Do you think there's too many of those people like you talked about where it's not the one big incident that's easy, right? Hey, it's you just can't go on after what you did.
You're going to jail.
But it's the paper cuts, right? The death by paper cut, the same person paper cut all the time. And you know, over the course of their career, they get this reputation for just, like you said, being a pain in the ass, being terrible. Not somebody that they see as a leader. No one has any trust in their abilities or their decision-making abilities. Do you think that there's too much of that in the fire service? Do you think it's getting better? Do you think it's getting worse?
I don't think it's getting worse or better. Honestly, not from what I've seen. I think that you have challenges in running an organization. And one of the premier challenges is dealing with the people in the organization, their behavior and their performance. And the problem is you don't get to deal with every one of them. You asked me to answer this as a fire chief.
Yeah.
Fire chief doesn't get to deal with every one of the...
No.
And I'm not talking about paper cuts. I know how to deal with paper cuts. I'm talking about bigger things than that that don't get dealt with. I'm talking about people being rude to customers. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people intimidating other employees. I'm talking about people not doing their jobs. I'm talking about people not taking care of their equipment.
So how do you deal...
I'm talking about those people.
What's the best way to deal with that as a fire chief?
There's a set of things that need to occur for you to have accountability in an organization. Okay? There needs to be a system in place. There needs to be procedures in place. There needs to be rules in place. There needs to be a system of consequences and rewards in place. Okay, and there needs to be strong first level supervision in place. And that's where the accountability really comes in. Strong first level supervision, and that's not a rank, that's a role. If you're an assistant fire chief, your first level supervisor is a fire chief. If you're a captain, your first level supervisor is a battalion chief. Mm-hmm. If you're a battalion chief, it's a deputy chief. If you're a firefighter or an engineer, it's a captain. Strong first level supervisory skills, you can look them up online if you want to. If you're doing that set of things, you don't have any problem with accountability. If you're only doing them some of the time, you've got some problems with accountability. If you're not doing them at all, if you're showing up thinking you're a working foreman or something on a fire truck, then I'm not really a supervisor. I'm kind of one of the guys. Then you're asking for it. And what happens then, something bad goes wrong. And usually when something really happens that gets out, okay, that's... I feel sorry for them, but that's when some people find out how much authority they had and they didn't use it.
Yeah.
It is when they find themselves in trouble over something somebody else did who works for them.
Yeah.
I had a guy one time, he was a captain, and I get called in the middle of the night at home, and this 16-year-old girl had been at one of our fire stations and had gone home and told her parents about something that happened there. Okay. When the shift commander went over and talked to everybody about it, he said he thought he'd better call me. So I went over there. And this captain told me, I'll never forget it because I felt like strangling him. He told me that he was in bed and that I can't hold him responsible for what happens at his station when he's in bed. And I said, you know, I thought I had a captain on duty here. Could you call me the next time you decide to go to bed and leave a 16-year-old girl out in the goddamn TV room with your crew when you knew she was there? I'll send a captain out here if you'll just call me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And how stupid that was. What poor judgment that was. And what a total lack of understanding of what responsibility you had when something like that happens. That I'm not responsible for that. I was in bed. Now, I was awake and out there when she got there and when they were flirting with her and when she was sitting on someone's lap, and I was awake for that, but that ain't... I wasn't awake for that other stuff.
Yeah, ultimately you are responsible.
Yes. And I use that as an example because the guy was so serious.
Yeah, if I just go in my room, this isn't happening.
I'll pretend it didn't happen. I'll go to sleep. Then I don't have to tell her to go home. I don't have to tell my crew to quit that. I don't have to I don't have to exercise anything.
Yeah.
But it's the same. When I was in the military, and every job I've had since, the people who understand what first-level supervisors are responsible for and do it, and I don't mean hard-ass do it. I don't mean in-your-face do it. Mm-hmm. I just mean do it. Do what you're responsible for.
Right.
Help people prevent themselves from ruining their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a chief tell me that one time, not because I was doing anything wrong, but as advice, he said, when you have those difficult conversations with your crew or your peers or whoever, it's you're not coming down on them because you want to come down on them or make them feel bad. You're trying to prevent them from making a career-limiting decision. So don't look at me as the bad guy because I tell you that your girlfriend has to go home because it's 10 o'clock at night or whatever. Look at it as me helping you and trying to keep you from making a career-limiting decision.
Or better yet, Brendan, I'm not going to let you.
Yes.
Don't even think I'm going to let you.
Yeah.
We're not doing that here.
Yeah.
You know, this is we're not going to do that here. Put that in your mind on the headline of a social media site or a newspaper. And then do you really want that out and about?
Yeah.
You know, do you really expect the fire department to be able to deal with something like that? You know?
Yeah, the headline test. Always a good test before you do something. If this was the headline in the news tonight, would you still do it?
And now it's even worse than that. You know, we got to be stupid without the internet.
Right.
You know, my generation did. Nowadays,
everybody's going to know.
Yeah. You know, you can't do that stuff anymore. You just can't do it. You couldn't do it before, but it happened.
Yeah.
And it happened because it pretty much stayed in the station. Nothing stays in the station anymore. And it's wrong anyway. You know?
So let's talk a little bit about your time in Washington and how you transitioned. And I know that you spent some time at the Pentagon. Tell us about how you ended up there and what you were doing.
So I flew to Washington, D.C. on September 10th, 2001. And I got in about midnight because I had to do a presentation here in Arizona for the Arizona Public Education Association of Public Educators. And that was in the afternoon. So I did the presentation, headed for the airport, got in late to Washington, D.C., and got a cab and headed over to Arlington, Virginia, right across the river, right across the Potomac, to do this presentation at the Crystal City Marriott. It wasn't a presentation, it was an exercise. The exercise was for a group called Safe USA. I'll never forget it. Safe USA. We get there, and right away we hear about what had happened in New York City. And I go by this room, and there's a group of employees that were in the room watching on this small TV up there, the planes that hit the plane, not the planes yet, mm-hmm. but the plane that hit the first tower. And then just after I watched that for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, the plane hit the second tower. Okay, so I'm walking from there to. You could tell that wasn't an accident, right? You know? So yeah. I'm walking from there to the room where I'm going to facilitate this planning session, and along the wall of the Crystal City Marriott on the mezzanine floor, it's all glass. Okay, and I'm walking along that glass, and all of a sudden this horrible. Called boom! I mean, this explosion, and the building shook. Of course, that's right across the highway from the Pentagon, and smoke, and flame everywhere, you know. And that plane, which I did not see, hit that Pentagon, And we were close enough to where we felt it. And then there was a secondary blast that we felt even harder a little bit later. So I used to command the Phoenix Urban Search and Rescue Team, the FEMA team. Mm-hmm. I did that for a while when I was in Phoenix Fire. We went to the Northridge earthquake. We were the first team on the scene at the Oklahoma City bombing. And so I knew a lot of those people, you know. So I caught up with the people there in who were working the Pentagon at the time, Fairfax County, in fact, their urban search and rescue team. And so I went there and worked with them. And then they got me all my credentials and everything and uniform. The next thing I know, it's Thursday. That happened on Tuesday. Next thing I know, it's Thursday. And I get a call to go to New York City and work with FEMA on the World Trade Center. So I take a train real early in the morning. Like it was like 1 o'clock in the morning or something on Friday morning. And get up there, and so for the next 2.5 weeks, I worked there with FEMA mostly on structuring that command system that they were trying to put in place there, and some of the equipment that they needed. You know, we had really good breathing canisters and masks and stuff over at the Pentagon. We didn't have anything at the World Trade Center, nothing. They even ran out of those little masks.
Yeah.
We had nothing.
So we had Lieutenant Eddie Cancrow on the podcast. He was our first episode. He was there September 11th that morning. He was on scene at the Trade Center. And one of the things that he talked about was that there, in the beginning, he said there was no command structure. He said there was a command. It got decimated when the towers fell. That was it. There was no command structure. So him and his team just started climbing into the rubble and pulling people out. I think he was there 36 hours straight for his first rotation. 36 hours, no nap, no nothing, just working. So your job, if I'm hearing it correctly, was to try to get that command structure back in place. It'd been decimated.
Really not back in place.
In place for the first time.
In place.
Time. Yeah.
Because it was, imagine about a 14-acre site. And so that system had to control access to the area. It needed to be decentralized. The command structure needed to be decentralized, and where I did most of my work was right by the pile, right there. Mm-hmm. At the pile, and there were about five of us who worked on that system. There was a command center that had been set up, but it wasn't on site. It was a mm-hmm. little ways off. We worked on communications. We worked on lobby. We worked on rehab. We worked on all the things you'd think you would work on. Mm-hmm. If you had six separate sites that were trying to coordinate and handle this with a large center that was off-site.
How long were you in New York working on the 9/11 incident?
About 2.5 weeks.
Okay.
Okay, about 2.5 weeks, and then I came home. Those guys that were working that pile when I got there, some of them had been there since it happened.
Yeah.
The look on their faces, it was just amazing to me. And see, I knew a bunch of the people who died there. A bunch of them. When we were at the Oklahoma City bombing, the New York team and the Phoenix team worked the same shift. So we worked 12 on, 12 off, and we paired up. The team Phoenix paired up with was New York City. So we knew that team, mm-hmm. you know, and they were mostly gone. The fire chief and I, Gansey, we were friends. He was gone. We'd had dinner together in New Orleans on August 31st. You know, and then a few days later, he's gone. You know, it's a that was not going to be a short-term deal, and right. It was obvious. And they were that department was just decimated.
Yeah, I can't.
I'm sure that guy told you.
I can't even fathom losing 343 firefighters at one time. Was that one of the most difficult things about setting up the command structure? Is who's in charge now? You've lost all these chiefs and captains and lieutenants. Figuring out who to put in what place now. The fire chief is gone. Was that a difficult part, is figuring out who's next in line? Who's going to command this thing? Who's going to be in charge of these sectors?
To me, that wasn't hard because New York City ran that. FDNY ran that. First of all, they would have never let you take it away from them.
Right.
Just like Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
There ain't no way you're going to take that incident away from those people. So you become support for them. And they have to decide how they're going to move people through the ranks for those. And they did that, you know, they did that. They had that command center that was off-site slightly, mm-hmm. and they were able to work what they needed to do and all of that. But the hard thing was getting them the equipment they needed, you know, the communications equipment that they needed on site so that they could talk to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a problem when it fell.
Right.
Because they couldn't talk to each other. It was still a problem when we got there. We had to get mobile communications capability at each of those six sites. And, it was just, they decided who was going to supervise what for their fire department.
Yeah.
We were there to assist them however we could.
Yeah.
But on the other end of that is also a group of USAR teams who are there to work. You know,
yeah.
Who also knew all those guys, many of them, not all of them, but many of them. I mean, there are only 20 some, I think it's 26 USAR teams in the country. So if you'd been in USAR much at all, you knew each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's those are definitely the most difficult incidences when you have first responders that are down. It certainly hits on a different level than a, what I guess you would call a normal incident. When you know that some of your brothers and sisters have gone down, and that it just hits on a different level.
I've actually worked a lot of those on the scene, mm-hmm. Of several incidents where we lost firefighters over my career. And it is a very trying situation for them. What we did in Oklahoma City was very difficult on those guys. I mean, it was very similar, in fact, to what you saw going on in Miami the last period of time. If you look at those photos of Miami and photos of mm-hmm. Oklahoma City, that building went down very similarly.
Yeah.
The rubble piles were situated very similarly. The rubble piles were part of what was holding up the building very similarly.
Yeah.
The building wasn't stable very similarly.
Right.
And the guy that was running that for Metro Dade was the Metro Dade USAR commander in Oklahoma City. So.
Yeah. Not his first time.
Not his first time.
So I know that you've written a few books. Do you want to talk about the why you chose to write those books and where people can find them?
Well, I've written five or six books now. Three of them are out of print. And I replaced them with one called Progressive Leadership Principles, Concepts, and Tools. that book replaced those three.
Okay.
That went out. And then Mental Aspects of Performance for Firefighters and Fire Officers is the other one. And I'm actually going to write one more that will put probably both of those books out of circulation. One last one.
Where can people get those books if they want to read them now?
From IFSTA and Fire Protection Publications, right off their site.
Okay.
They sell them out of their catalog or off their site, however you want
when's
to buy
new,
them.
When's the new book coming out?
It's going to be a while. I've got it outlined, but I haven't even started writing it.
Okay.
You know, I'm still kind of getting my mind around what I want to say.
Yeah. Are you fully retired now, or what are you working on now?
You know, I'm not fully retired. I'm still speaking now and then. I still do executive advisement often. I do strategic planning, and I like that. I enjoy doing that for organizations that really want to do it. And I still write a lot.
So, well, don't be too rough when you read my book. I wrote it in crayon.
No. I'm sure your book's just fine. No, I've written a lot, and I enjoy writing. I'm fortunate that anybody's ever interested in them, frankly.
That's how I felt, too. Yeah. Of course, my book's not quite on the same level as your books, but
I'm sure it is.
A blessing that people I'm just sure want to read it.
I'm sure it is just fine and dandy.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. We're way over on time, but I don't care. I mean, we have no parameters on this podcast. You have so much to talk about. I'm sure maybe I'll drag you back in here later on in a few months or so. We can get into some more of your stories because you've had so much experience throughout your whole career across the whole country. And there's so much that we have to learn from you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come and pass some of that knowledge on to the younger people and give us some guidance.
Well, this is always fun to do these kinds of things, and Brendan, I don't know if I'm passing along much knowledge or not, but what I hope I pass along are little nuggets that make you think, you know, that you might remember someday when you're confronted with some situation of your own.
Yeah, definitely.
Or that comes to mind.
Definitely. I think there was a lot of really good takeaways for sure, especially when we're talking about accountability and leadership and committees and making decisions. I think there's a lot of good stuff to take away from it. So, well, thank you so much for coming. Really appreciate you, and I'm sure we'll get you back in here again one day.